BBC presents My Word. And here to introduce the programme and the panel is Jack Longland.
My Word is a word game played by people whose business is words. And those taking part are Anne Scott-James, Dillis Powell, Frank Muir, and Dennis Norton. Round one tries to test their vocabulary. 2 marks if they can get the meaning of these words right. And we begin with Anne Scott-James. Anne, I'd like to know what's the meaning of the verb anathematize. Anathematize.
Anathema is something you loathe. Anathematize means to denounce or curse.
Yes, that's absolutely right. To put under a ban or to curse. And anathema is often used rather lightly these days. So-and-so is anathema to me. But really, you're saying something pretty terrible if you do say that. It means that he's accursed of God and should be excommunicated by his church. Anathematized, to curse. Frank Muir, what is ennui? E-N-N-U-I, ennui.
Ooh, yes, it's a contemporary French playwright. He wrote Check It and Ring Round the Moon. It's also an old English word, or Middle English word, meaning the eighth born son. There's an old ballad which says, I'm ennui the eighth. And it also means boredom through lack of activity.
Yes.
A kind of mental stagnation.
That's what you'll get your 2 marks for. Mental weariness from lack of occupation or lack of interest, a particularly intense form of boredom, comes from Latin in odio, the same word roughly as annoy. Dillis Powell, what is a capote? C-A-P-O-T-E.
It's a hood.
Yes.
It is.
Well, yes, that's the top bit of it.
Well, it's a cloak with a hood.
Yes, that's it.
Like Christopher Robin's nanny's dressing gown. It's a beautiful blue, but it hasn't a capote.
That's roughly it. Soldiers, or it could be a traveller's, long cloak with a hood. And it's French, from a diminutive from cape, capote. 2 marks. Dennis Norton, what is a die dapper?
Die dapper.
Yes.
Well, too, it sounds like die dapper. It sounds like a suicide pilot who takes care of his uniform.
I think it sounds much more like an American baby's nappy.
Would it help you if I called it dive dapper?
That would help tremendously. That is a great help.
It's a plunger bird.
That's right.
It's a bird which comes swooping down with a tremendous beak and gets fish out of the water.
Yes, it's a bird. Yes, that sounds good.
All right,
good.
1.5, because again, I give it quite a lot of help. It is short for dive dapper, die dapper. Small diving waterfowl, such as the little grebe or the dabchick. Well, before we begin round two, I give each team a quotation for them to write down. And then the 2 women members of the team go on studying those quotations. And at the end of the program, I shall ask them where the quotations come from. So first of all, Anne Scott-James and Dennis, your quotation is, was this the face that launched 1,000 ships? And Dillis Powell and Frank Muir, yours is, a rose-red city half as old as time. And then at the end of the program, I shall ask Dennis and Frank to give me their idea of how these words came to be said or written. And so to round two, which is questions on mythology and legend. 2 marks, if you get them right. Anne Scott-James, who was Stentor? S-T-E-N-T-O-R. Stentor.
He was a man who roared.
He did.
Very loud voice.
Yes. On what kind of occasions?
Greek occasion.
Yes.
Greek occasion, yes. Right.
Yes. Specifically right. Was Greek, yes. Who was he roaring at?
He must have been roaring.
Stuffed
sure,
finally.
We get him in the Odyssey, don't we?
Yes, that's it.
Yes, he was roaring at Odysseus and his ship.
Roaring.
And his merry men.
No, he's roaring at the other side. Who are the other side?
Roaring at the Trojans, was
yes,
he now?
Yes, more than that. Yes.
I'm sorry, but I've forgotten that.
Yes, 2 marks. He was the herald of the Greeks in front of Troy while they were besieging Troy. And he was terribly useful because all the Trojans could hear him from an awful long way away because his voice was as loud as the voice of 50 ordinary men. He was a sort of super town crier. Tomorrow. Thank me. Who was Europa?
Very, very lovely lady.
Yes.
She was Zeus's, what the history books call, good friend. And
how did they become good friends?
She was snatched away to Crete, and the rest of the story is bull.
2 marks, lest Frank goes any further. She was the daughter of a Phoenician king, and she was, as Frank says, so lovely that Zeus, the king of the gods, fell in love with her and did one of his well-known transformations in order to get away with her. He waited till Europa was playing on the beach with her attendants, and then Zeus came out of the waves, probably roaring, in the shape of a white bull, and he was so tame that Europa climbed onto his back, and he swam all the way with her to Crete. And there she became the mother of Minos and Rhadamanthus and Sarpedon, and also the ancestress of all of us in Europe. So quite a girl. 2 marks. Dillisbau, who was Pheidippides?
Pheidippides ran.
Yes, he ran.
He ran. And he ran the marathon race.
He did?
The first marathon.
Why?
Because he wanted to bring the news to Athens. Mm-hmm. About the victory at Marathon.
What happened at the end of the race?
He fell down dead.
Well done. 2 marks it is.
Like me.
The Marathon, the race founded because of this, of course, didn't start then. It started when the Olympic Games were reinstituted at the end of the 19th century. And the distance of the Marathon is exactly, in its modern race, the distance between Marathon and Athens, which is, I'm told, 26 miles and 385 yards. Dennis Norton, who were the Satyrs? S-A-T-Y-R-S, Satyrs.
Well, they were men with goats where their trousers ought to be.
Yes.
In other words, they were goats from above, from below the waist.
Yes, and what did they...
And they hung around the woods.
Mm.
And they went after the nymphs. It's all very contemporary, you know.
Yes, 2 marks it is. Creatures of the woods and mountains. They were half man, half beast, like their master, Pan. And as Dennis hints, they were idle and lascivious, representing the vital powers of nature. And they had bodies of men, but the pointed ears of a goat, and as well the horns and the hooves and tails of goats. They weren't at all nice to know, especially for young ladies. Well, the next round is about origins and derivations. 3 marks if teams can define the present meanings and then give me the origin or derivation of these words or expressions or phrases. And Anne Scott James, yours is to see how things pan out.
Well, it means to see what happens,
mm-hmm.
how events turn out.
Yes. And in origin?
Pan for gold. Could it be anything to do with that?
Yes.
Well, that's about it, isn't it? Pan for gold means...
What did you do?
Sifting it. Sifting the gold from the rubbish and the... The dirty
cigarette
ore.
Ends.
Oh, yes.
Orange peel.
And the other stuff which you find in gold mines.
Yes, that's good enough. It's not a terribly scientific description, Anne, but it'll do. To see how things pan out, to see what happens, to see how things turn out. From the old gold prospectors, and in the diggings, in order to separate the gold from the earth, soil was put in a shallow pan and washed in running water, and this washed away the mud, and the gold sank to the bottom of the pan. So when you held the pan up, you could see exactly how the thing had panned out. Frank Noah, boudoir.
It's a law. It's a room, a bedroom, distinguished by the fact that the lampshades have frilly bits around them and there are no ashtrays. It's milady's room.
Yes.
Fine. Good.
How does it come to have that meaning?
It's from the French, Jane.
To sulk. She went
to sulk. She went to sulk.
Yes.
It's the Marquis de Sulk. He was waiting in the boudoir.
Well, 3 marks. It is the wife's or young lady's own personal room to which males are not normally supposed to be invited. And it comes from the French word boudet, to sulk. It was known as the sulking place, where the wife went when she was terribly, terribly upset. Tell us, Powell, on the side of the angels.
Well, it means on the right, virtuous, moral side.
Mm-hmm. And comes from?
Well, it comes from being on the side of the angels. It comes from
a debate in the House of Commons and was said by Benjamin Disraeli.
Yes.
And the debate was on Darwin's Origins of Species. And they had to decide whether... I think the question was asked whether men, in fact, were on the side of the apes or the angels.
You've got everything right except what the sporting press calls the venue. It was a famous speech by Disraeli, and it was at the Oxford Diocesan Conference in 1864, not in the House of Commons. And he was discussing the Darwinian theory and said, the question is this, is man an ape or an angel? I, my lord, am on the side of the angels. And nowadays it means to be on the side of right or accepted values or establishment. Dennis Norden, dominoes.
Same to you, Jack. Well, it's that game that you play in pubs or when children have got measles in bed. You know. What does it come from?
It doesn't go back to the Latin, does it?
Is it dominus?
Yes.
A dominus, master.
No, domina and mistress.
Or domina. I was trying to avoid that.
A lady.
All right. 1.5 for ingenuity. Nowadays, a game played with small tablets of plastic or ivory or wood with varying numbers of dots on them, and it began with monks in a monastery in France, two of whom invented the game, playing it with square stones on which they'd mark these little dots. And the winner of each game, when he did win, said, Dixit Dominus Domino Meo, which is the first line of the service of Vespers in the evening. And eventually all the other monks became Johnny, and they couldn't say that long phrase every time anybody won, so they just said domino. And sometimes you'll find old players in a pub who, when they win finally, do say domino. 1.5 out of 3. Well, the next round's a quickie round. Questions about mysteries and thrillers, some of them vintage ones and some of them newer. 2 marks. Anne Scott James. Who was Irene Adler?
Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah. She was the lady with a problem in Sherlock Holmes. You said a quickie. I've been quick.
Yeah. That's good enough. 2 marks. She's the only woman that Sherlock Holmes ever found himself very deeply attracted to. Irene Adler. Frank Muir, who was Karamane?
The moonstone.
No.
Fu Manchu.
Yes.
Sex Roma.
Yes.
Wrote Fu Manchu.
Yes. She's the beautiful Oriental girl, and she appears in all the Fu Manchu series by Sex Roma, and Dr. Petrie was infatuated by her. And that must have been jolly nice for him. Dennis Power, who was Chief Inspector Roderick Allen, or I'm not certain whether he isn't called Alain, because it's spelled A-L-L-E-Y-N.
He's the detective in a novel by one of the women detective writers.
Yes.
Not Margie Allingham.
No.
Nio Marth.
That's right. Chief Inspector Roderick Allen of Scotland Yard is the favourite detective of Nio Marsh in, I think, pretty nearly all her detective stories. Dennis Norden, what's the name of the very last Ian Fleming novel about James Bond?
The Man with the Golden Gun.
That's it. Mm. Well, now we come to the last round, and we go back to the quotations I gave the two teams earlier on in the program. And to begin with, for 2 marks, Anne Scott James, can you give me the origin of your quotation? Was this the face that launched 1,000 ships?
Yes, it's from Marlowe's Faust.
Yes?
It's when all the phantoms are being... when the phantom of Helen is being shown to Faust.
Absolutely right. 2 marks. Dennis Powell, the origin of your quotation, a rose-red city half as old as time.
It's a line from a poem, the author of which I don't know, and it refers to Petra.
And Petra is?
It's miles away in the east, and it has terrific sort of Greek temples and carvings and Roman
Actually,
things.
Actually, it's a lot of holes in the cliff.
It's in a gorge.
Yeah. I always longed to go there. I've never been able to get there yet.
Yes, the main point is the rocks are a wonderful sort of red
rose-red colour.
Rose-red colour.
It's by some rather obscure person who's not famous. It's a name like Thomas.
Not quite, but still. 1.5 for topographical accuracy, I think. It's a poem called Petra, and it was written by the Reverend John William Burgon, B-U-R-G-O-N, and it does refer to this rose-red city in the gorge. Well, now I'm going to ask Frank and Dennis to give me their explanations of how these quotations came into being, and on this occasion, the marks will go to whichever incredible explanation receives the longer amount of applause from the audience here in the theatre. So back to Dennis Norden with his quotation. Was this the face that launched 1,000 ships?
When I look across stage at Frank, sitting there with a sensitive, aristocratic face, and I think back to the very first time when I ever saw him, hollow-eyed, gaunt, unshaven, unwashed, dressed in rags, standing in the gutter in Old Compton Street, holding out a greasy cloth cap and singing, "Ramona." And I prodded him gingerly with my umbrella. And I said, "Look here, my good pauper. When did you last eat?" And he said, "7 weeks ago, Gav." Gnawing at my umbrella very well. And I said, "Would you be interested in a proposition which might bring you food?" And he said, "I'd do anything, Gav. I'd do anything. I'm starving. I'm just starving." I said, "Stop it." Quickly, I hailed a cab and bundled him in. And inside the cab, I told him my predicament. You see, at that time, this was many years ago, I was in great trouble with the income tax. See, what had happened is, I'd taken out this submissive bird to a fish and chip place for lunch. The bill had come to 15 shillings. Now, thinking to evade some income tax, I had altered the 15 shillings to 150 shillings and sent it off as part of my business expenses, noting it down as lunch with a colleague. However, the income tax inspector had written back saying that he queried this, would I go and see him? I went and saw him, and he brought this bill out. He says, 150 shillings, lunch with a colleague. He said, how could two people possibly eat food to the value of £7.10 in a fish and chip shop? So I said, well, my colleague ordered extra chips. He said, I have investigated these figures. He said, let us assume that the two meals that you ate came to 15 shillings. He said, this would mean, he said, a portion of chips is approximately 2 shillings. In order to bring the bill up to £7.10, your colleague would have had to have eaten 67.5 portions of chips. He said, but look here, my dear fellow. He said, 67.5 portions. He said, there's roughly 15 chips in a portion. He said, that's nearly 1,000 he'd have to eat. I said, well, he did. He said, well, quite frankly, Mr. Norden, he said, I don't believe your story. You know the way they talk. And he said, unless you can produce this colleague, he said, I shall pray that the Inland Revenue will be prosecuting you for fraud. So I said, well, of course I can produce him. I said, what's more, if you'll come to Fred's Fish and Chip Shop next Thursday, he'll be there. He said, I will be there next Thursday at lunchtime. And there we left it. And it was on this particular Thursday that I'd met Frank there in the gutter. And I suddenly thought, this is the man, a man as hungry as this. He is my only chance. So I took him back to my luxury flat over the chemist shop in the parade. And I outfitted him in a tweed suit and a bow tie, sprayed him down a bit with aftershave lotion, and took him to Fred's Fish and Chip Shop, where the tax inspector was waiting, and the waiter came up. It was one of these kind of expatriate mafia that they have in these places. And I said, 3 portions of fish and chips, please, with 67.5 portions of extra chips for my friend. Which he bought, and Frank woofed the lot. Not only woofed them, but sat back after them and said, what's for pud? Well, As you can imagine, the inspector was duly impressed and went out full of apologies and, I hope, indigestion. And I turned to Frank and said, "Thank you very much, my good man. Here's something for your trouble," and pressed a sixpence into his hand, which he waved aside and said, "I think I'm onto a better thing than that." And I said, "What do you mean?" And he said, "Well," he said, "unless you take me into partnership in whatever racket you're engaged in," he said, "I shall spill the whole beans to the constabulary." And that is how our long and happy association started. Now, you look as if you don't believe this. And, in fact, it is hard to believe. In fact, every time I look across the stage at Frank, I think to myself, was this the face that lunched on 1,000 chips?
Well, the secret's out at last. I always wanted to know how they began in partnership, and I know. So we go on to Frank Muir. Heaven knows what he's going to say, but his quotation was, "A rose-red city half as old as time."
I had one of those humiliating experiences with my son about 5 years ago. As my wife was out for the afternoon shopping, I lent him my tennis racket and said, "Go and bang a ball against the side of the house and keep out of mischief." That's the side of the house where there are no windows. Now. And about 20 minutes later, he came back, and the behind was out of his new jeans. So I said to him, "What's happened? What's happened with those new jeans?" He said, "It was an accident. A rose-red city, half as old as time. You know, because O.O.'s got a new puppy." O.O. The boy next door is called Robert. He said, "No, we call him 007, because his mummy gave him a packet of that stuff you sprinkle down cracks in the cement. And from then on, we called him 007, because he's licensed to kill ants." And O.O.'s got this new puppy, you see, which is terribly docile, because his mummy wouldn't let him have it until the lady guaranteed that it was docile. And then, of course, tying Sally to the tree. And then I accidentally cut the string on the tennis racket. He said, "Daddy, do you know it's only one string?" He said, "Well, I needed the string, you see, because I had to tie Sally to the tree because she was being Minnie Uh-uh. So I wanted to tie her to the tree because I was going to scalp her. And then I wanted to put the voodoo on her, you see, Daddy. So I went into the back into the kitchen, and in the refrigerator I found a bone. So I said, there isn't a bone in the refrigerator." He said, "Well, there's a bit of red meat stuff around it, but there's a bone in the middle." I cut the meat away, Daddy, and I got the bone, and I went back and I put the voodoo on Sally. I said, "You're Minnie Uh-uh," and I point this bone towards you, and she got out. She got away from her bondages. And she escaped right into the long grass, and whoosh, and she ran, and she disappeared into the long grass in the orchard. So I wonder what to do. And I thought, you see, Daddy, I thought of O.O.'s dog next door, his little puppy, which is a red setter, and Heifer sold it. I said, "Heifer?" He said, "He bought it from that lady, you know, that old lady with the large legs and the moustache." "Mrs. Constable Spofforth." He said, "Well, Sally actually heard you saying to Mammy that she was a bit of a cow. So ever since..." So Heifer, you see, had sold this lovely puppy, Daddy, with huge feet. And it's all a sort of red colour. And the puppy was guaranteed docile because the last one bit O.O. But Mrs. Spofforth said, "No, he's terribly calm, won't hurt children." And we never played with the puppy. And I thought, here's a chance, because we can see if the puppy's a hunter, see if it'll hunt things out. And we'll set it hunting Sally in the long grass. So I went, "Shh, shh, ow!" I said, and... okay. And I lay down in the long grass. And I said, "Come on, dog, come on." And just waiting for this red setter to bound up. And suddenly, oh, Daddy, it was terrible. There's a
All slathering and all jaws and tufts of sort of really fur jumped on my back as I was lying on the grass. Like fierce claws going all out my back. And suddenly there's a terrible rending sound, and suddenly my bottom felt all cold. And when I looked up, Daddy, the little red-setter puppy was galloping all back towards O.O.'s house, and it had the bone, which was in my hip pocket, you see, Daddy. And also the hip pocket, too, in its mouth. And that was how it happened. So I said it was this supposedly guaranteed docile puppy that did it. He looked at me as though I was an idiot. Daddy, I told you when you asked me. And I remembered I'd said, "What brought about this expensive accident?" And he replied, "O.O.'s red setter, heifer sold as tame."
Well, life must be very exciting with the Muir family. By your vote, Dennis Norton wins the competition of the two stories, and that brings us to a final score in which, nevertheless, Dillis Power and Frank Muir win by 2 marks from Anne Scott James and Dennis, and it also brings to an end this edition of My Word.
In My Word, you heard Dillis Powell, Anne Scott James, Frank Muir, and Dennis Norton, introduced by Jack Longland. The program was devised by Tony Schryan and Edward J. Mason, and presented by the BBC. Thank you.